Welcome to the Ledbury Poetry Festival. And I've just got one or two things of housekeeping to do first. First of all, fire exits, should there be a need. One at the centre back, one at the right at the back, and this one here behind the curtain for quick escape. And today we're very grateful to have sponsoring this event, the Arts Council, who sponsor the whole festival and without whom we would find it difficult to run the whole thing, but also Modern Poetry in Translation, and especially the Stephen Spender Memorial Trust, who I believe has been a major sponsor for this particular event. I'd like to welcome Sasha Dugdale, who is going to referee the duel between Irina Shuvalova and William Blacker, who are going to be the translators of Katerina Kalitko's poem, which I hope you all have printed. And that's enough from me. I'm going to hand over to Sasha to introduce the two translators.
Hello, thanks very much for coming along. It is an incredibly hot day. This is an incredibly hot room, and I think it shows more than the usual devotion to translation that you're all here. Before we go any further, I'd like to add my thanks as well, particularly to the Ledbury Festival that so generously has hosted this translation duel for 2 years running. It's a brilliant event, and although it's a small audience, I know that you'll find it a compelling event, and you'll probably leave feeling that something has been revealed to you about the process of translation and about poetry itself. You should have all been given a leaflet as you came into the hall. Can you just lift your hand if you haven't got this leaflet here? Have you all got a copy? Would you mind all picking it up and just having a quick look at it, and I'll just talk you through it so you know what you've got. The leaflet has on it, as well as biog notes and the original Ukrainian poem, the part that will be most useful to you today, which is if you open it out onto the poster, you get a really lovely poster with this session. And then you fold it in half. It's beginner's origami. I'm going to turn it into a paper swan in a minute. And you can then have a look very easily at the two versions of the same poem that we'll be discussing today. So you'll be able to see William's translation and Irina's translation and compare them for yourselves. And I think that's going to be quite useful to you during the conversation to have them in front of you. This is a very open forum sort of event. The second half of the event, we hope that you'll join in too. So if you have a pen or a pencil to make notes on the translation or things you want to ask about, then do that. And yes, I'll move to you in a minute and you'll be able to discuss the poems as well. But I would like, first of all, to introduce the poets and to tell you a little bit about the format for the duel. What I want to say is that the word duel is incredibly misleading, and it is, unfortunately, a piece of very brutal marketing to get bums on seats. We promise bloodthirsty action. In fact, it's a very peaceable event, and it's a very calm and peaceable event, and it's almost the opposite of a duel, of a competitive bloodletting. It's about two translators, two poets, talking about the different ways in which they understand a poem, and they brought that understanding to the creative act of translation. So you can see it is actually more Buddhist than dualist. The two dualists today, William Blacker and Irina Shuvalova, will come up onto the stage in a minute. Irina will come and read the original Ukrainian poem by Katerina Kalitko. Sadly, Katerina can't be with us. She should have been here for the duel and the reading this evening as one of the Vesopolis poets, but unfortunately she has family illness and couldn't come. So in her place, Irina will read the original Ukrainian poem, and that's really important that you hear the sounds of the Ukrainian and that you can hear how the poem is shaped in its original language. then Irina will read her English version of the poem, her translation, and then William will come up onto the stage and read his translation of the poem, and you can read along in the leaflet. And after you've heard the poem in Ukrainian and English, we'll have a brief discussion about some of the really big differences. We'll talk a little bit about the context of the poem, and then we'll hand over to you to become involved in the discussion. So, very, very brief biographies. William is an academic, a translator, and a member of a theatre company. His research crosses boundaries. He looks at literature and culture from Poland, Russia, and Ukraine, and he focuses on areas of cultural memory and urban culture. He has translated a great deal of Ukrainian literature, particularly, and his translations were included in the anthology Words for War, the recent Ukrainian anthology of poetry, particularly concerning the war in Donbas region. The most recent translations I've seen by William, I really urge you to look out. These are translations of the short stories by Oleg Sentsov. And some of you, I hope, will know that Oleg Sentsov is a filmmaker, a Ukrainian filmmaker, who is currently being held in prison in Russia and is on a hunger strike. And I think it's pretty much nearly the... he's been on a hunger strike for a couple of months in Russia. And William has been translating his short stories for Pen, and they are all online. So I really urge you to go and read those translations as a sign of solidarity with Oleg. Irina is a poet and a translator. Her collections in Ukrainian have won prestigious prizes in her own country. But she also translates poetry into English, and she translates her own poetry into English and the poetry of other poets. And that's something I hope we might manage to discuss today, the difference between translating your own words into another language and someone else's. As a translator, she won the inaugural Brodsky Prize, which is part of the Stephen Spender Prize range, and she's also been published in Modern Poetry in Translation, most recently in last year's issue of Russian-Ukrainian Poetry. She is currently studying for a PhD at Cambridge University, and her PhD concerns folk and oral culture, and that is again in the context of the war in Donbas. Katerina Kalitko is one of the Versopolis poets for this year. She is a poet who has published 6 collections in Ukrainian. I think they've pretty much all won prizes. Irina told me earlier today that she thinks of Kalitko as one of the, if not the strongest poet of her generation in Ukraine. And her awards won't mean a great deal to any of us, but she did win the BBC Book Award for 2017. So I'm going to invite Irina to the stage to read Katerina's poem, and then to read her English translation. Irina.
Thanks so much for the introduction, Sasha. Hello, everyone. It's lovely to be here. I've already spent a wonderful morning exploring the ancient woods nearby, so I feel very much energized and invigorated, and hopefully I will be able to somehow channel that energy a little bit into the reading. So I will start with reading Katya's poem, Zmova Derev. This is how the title sounds in original. And if you read Ukrainian, if you happen to, you also can follow it because it's also included in the original booklet. Zmova Derev. І скажу тобі так. Ці дерева вкрадуть наші сни, вогке дно і грузьке у тутешніх сердець і містечок, а дерева не сплять. Ми виходимо в сад, і вони нас безлистими пальцями мовчки хапають за плечі. Темні пазурі гострі, і рани на тілі тонкі, проростають крізь нас ці дерева і не гояться з віком. Це ж бо ми. Це ж бо ми, що взяли собі їхніх батьків на ліжка і комоди, на мисники, двері та вікна. В дерев'яному ліжку із різьбленням у головах, що його 5-й рік доїдає настирливий шашель, в казанкові грудей перемішую ребрами кашель і кажу: «Утікай через сад, де висока трава, до ріки, але пізно, вартує на березі човен. Дерев'яний хребет йому річка ламає і студить. Я хотіла би знати в обличчя те дерево, що крізь холодний туман припливе і наступить на груди. So this was Katya's beautiful poem, and I will read my translation then. Conspiracy of trees. I tell you, these trees will steal our sleep. Around here, towns and hearts are built on quagmire. Meanwhile, the trees never sleep. Out in the garden, in silence, they grab our shoulders with their leafless fingers. The dark, sharp claws mark our bodies with sink cuts. These trees pierce us through. Even time cannot heal this. For it was we who took their parents away, making them into cupboards and beds, into doors and windows. I'm sprawled in my wooden bed, under a headboard carved by persistent woodworms. Stirring a cough in the pot of my chest, I say, run away, through the garden, through the high grass, to the river. Too late. A boat keeps watch on the bank. The river twists and numbs its wooden spine. I would like to know the face of that one tree that will sail out of the cold mist and step on my chest. Thanks very much. And should I guess, invite William to read his translation of this beautiful poem.
Thank you very much, Irina, for reading your beautiful translation. Thank you, Sasha, for the invitation to take part in this event. It's been a real pleasure to work with Katarina Kalitko's text, this really intriguing poem, and it's been a real pleasure to be here in Ledbury. Thank you also for mentioning Oleg Sentsov, because I think it's, you know, unfortunately, as has been the case so many times in the past, in Russia there are, and around Russia, there are amazing writers working, and unfortunately, sometimes they fall foul of the authorities, and Oleg Sentsov is one of those. So please, you know, if you haven't heard of him, look him up, read him, have a look at my translations and share them. You know, the reason for doing that was to raise awareness of his case. So anyway, back to what we're doing today. Conspiracy of the trees. And I'll tell you something. These trees will steal our dreams away. Around here, there's a dampness lying beneath small towns and hearts. But these trees do not sleep. We go out to the orchard and they paw at our shoulders in silence with their thin, leafless hands. Their dark claws are sharp. The wounds on our bodies are fine. They grow through us, these trees. The wounds don't heal with time. For it was we who took their parents for ourselves to build beds and chests, doors, windows, and shelves. In this wooden bed with carvings either side, which for 5 years has been the dogged woodworm's feast, with a rib I stir the cauldron of my cough in my breast, and I say, run away, through the orchard where the grass is high, to the river. But too late. A boat is guarding the bank, its wooden spine broken and cooled by the water. I would like to look in the face of the tree that will swim through the cold mist and step on my chest. Thank you.
I'd like to, first of all, thank Irina and William for those readings and just make a really small comment, which is already when you hear both of the translators read their poems, you hear how their translations fit their voices, which is something that I didn't notice on the page. But when you read, I suddenly felt the poem speak, the voice of the poem, which is already just something interesting about translation, two very different voices embodying the same poem. Before we start talking particularly about that poem, I'd like to ask Irina just to talk a little bit about Katerina, her position, the context of this poem within the collection, and what you feel needs saying about her work.
So this poem comes from the collection of poems that Katya published in 2014, relatively recently. But then it also seems like a long time away if you think about what happened in span of this past 4 years in Ukraine, which was, you know, the Maidan revolution, the annexation of Crimea, the war in Donbas, lots of things. So this have been the busy 4 years. And somehow, in many ways, I would say that this collection of Katya's was one of the first and strongest collections dealing with the issue of war, of violence brought about by war, although it was written before the actual outbreak of war. So this has to do with the fact that Katya, who is Ukrainian, she comes from central Ukraine, from the city of Vinnytsia, which in Ukraine is seen as a bit of a sleepy but very comfortable place. So it's fairly big, but it's fairly calm as well, very historical, a great history of a Jewish community, for instance, in that city. So it's a city really steeped in history. Katya herself has studied Balkan studies, and she's been studying Balkan languages as well, so that's her academic background. And she happens to have very close connections with the Balkan countries, in particular Bosnia, where her partner also lives. So the war she was writing about a lot in this collection has been, or have been, because we should say multiple wars, the Balkan wars. But that resonated very much with what was happening in Ukraine when the book came out. And this has been something that's been inherent in Katya's writing for quite some time, even before. So if you look at this poem, for instance, that we've chosen to translate, in one way, it might be considered a bit of a domestic poem almost. I mean, you have a garden, you have a house, you have domestic objects. You have this, what could be a quaint space almost, but it's nothing, it's anything but quaint if you look at the poem itself, because there is a sense of danger, of underlying violence that's inherent in the poem. And this is something that I would say runs through Katya's work quite a bit. The sense of violence as being very much a part of the human experience. And as we see in this poem again, going beyond the human experience to being part of the natural world and our interaction with the natural world. So this I think is something very remarkable also in the context of Katya's voice being a woman writer's voice as well. And in Ukraine now we have quite a few very strong female poets in particular. And as Sasha mentioned, I would say that Katya is definitely one of the most remarkable voices. So I think it also brings about this interesting issue of the topic of domesticity and how that sort of quiet domesticity that was traditionally perceived as a woman's world is being viewed by a female poet as something inherently very violent and threatening and estranging between space, I suppose.
Thanks, Irina. That's a really useful kind of context around the poem and the collection. But I wanted to ask William a little bit of to give us a little bit of a wider context, really, because I think it's pretty unlikely that most of us will have an in-depth understanding of Ukrainian poetry at the moment. So I wondered if you could provide a very sketchy sort of background to the poem in a sort of wider national poetry consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, where to start?
Sorry.
I guess Ukraine, like, you know, a lot of cultures in East Central Europe is, you know, they're sometimes referred to as poezocentric. You know, if you see this word used occasionally. Cultures and nations that are kind of formed around, that really have literature and specifically poetry at the heart of them. Because of the sort of roots in romantic nationalist movements in the 19th century. And Ukraine is really quite a dramatic example of that. You know, the national poet Taras Shevchenko is really, you know, lots of countries have national poets, but the place of Shevchenko within Ukraine is quite really remarkable. Even, you know, even by, you know, someone comes from Scotland and, you know, Burns, you can get a bit sick of Robert Burns sometimes, but Shevchenko is everywhere. You have like three houses together in Ukraine, there'll be a Shevchenko monument, you know.
A Lenin and a Shevchenko.
A Shevchenko, maybe. More Shevchenkos than Lenins,
yes,
these days. But,
so.
But, you know, people know the poetry. The poetry is, you know, any sort of event of any significance in Ukraine tends to have some kind of poetry at it. Poetry is very strong in the culture. And it always has been, because I think, you know, obviously Ukraine in its history has, you know, Ukrainians got sort of political autonomy in a meaningful way, only really in modern history, only in 1991. And before that, the sort of the expression of the communal identity has been through literature and poetry in particular. I mean, there are reasons for that as well, because of the sort of restrictions on printing, you know, that have been on printing work in Ukrainian that have been in force. So, you know, in the Russian Empire, for example, it's very difficult to write novels in those situations where you can't print them and distribute them. But poetry, you know, poetry works. It's more practical. And that tradition has continued right through the sort of the Soviet period and into the... And it's interesting what happened to it after, you know, when Ukraine got independence. There was this time in the sort of the late 80s into the 90s when poetry seemed to become a bit less focused on the nation and the kind of political struggle and the sort of protecting of identity, and became more sort of carnivalesque and more sort of fun, and talk about, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll sort of thing. And you had this really interesting sort of period as well from the 80s onwards where the main poets in Ukraine were also writing the lyrics for the most popular rock bands as well. So in that sense as well, I think Ukraine is quite remarkable in that poetry is something which young people know. You know, it's not maybe, you know, in this country, we think of poetry as being something maybe for a slightly older audience, but in Ukraine, it's not like that. You know, and poets, a lot of the well-known poets are young, and they're very popular with young people. So, an event like this in Ukraine would probably have, you know, a panel of young poets and a really packed room full of students. You know, which is really something which is so strange when you go there. You know, coming from the UK, where it's just not like that. And, you know, my students, I know, I don't think they're huge poetry readers, to be honest, but in Ukraine it's not like that. You know, they're really, you know, figures like, for example, Serhii Zhadan, who's probably the foremost sort of contemporary poet, is also a rock star, but also a very, very sort of prominent social and political commentator as well, and someone who people generally in society look up to, you know, But then I think I would say recently we've had this kind of rolling back because of the crisis, because of the war. Poetry has had to kind of start to take on a bit more of that, you know, that responsibility for what's society do in this situation. You know, and poets are being kind of looked to again to give that sort of guidance to wider society. They're kind of taking on this responsibility again. And I think, you know, that sort of feeds into what Irina was saying about Katerina's poetry, which is, I think, a good example of that.
And do you feel, Irina talked about the way that war, I suppose, infiltrates the poetic language and ideas of domesticity. What do you feel about the poem? What are your, conceptually, I suppose, about the poem?
Yeah, I mean, it was so interesting to listen to your interpretation right now. And I guess I had sort of felt that underneath it, but I hadn't really formulated it for myself. That kind of violence that's, that sort of sense of threat, a threat that's in there. You know, and I know in your commentary you sort of hinted at some sort of atrocities or something. You know, I was thinking... maybe, yeah, there is something there, which I hadn't maybe quite picked up on the first time I read it. You know, I sort of focused more on the something, yeah, to do with our relationship with nature and a certain kind of violence and destructiveness that's in that sense. But, you know, maybe there's also something else going on here. And that the way that comes into domestic space, you know, into the domestic sphere is really interesting. And it's something that,
you know, now that I think about it, I've seen in other writers, like there's a very, one of the best known Ukrainian writers, Oksana Zabushko, who's a prose writer and also, but started out as a poet. And in her poetry as well, I think you often get this sense of the, that there are often domestic settings, there are often family settings, but also there's, you know, the sort of sense of underlying violence that's coming, that has its roots in sort of, you know, political, basically in sort of political circumstances and political violence outside that's coming into the domestic sphere. You know, that's something that I found in her work, for example. And then, and now, hearing what you said, I can sort of begin to see it here as well. Yeah.
Rina, what do you make of the title of the poem?
Well, actually, this is something William and I mentioned earlier, because we said, you know, we will have to talk about that article, that definite article.
So. I'm not, in some, well, yes, that's interesting, but I'm just quite interested in the title in itself. It's a really intriguing title. It hints at a lot more than...
Exactly, but also I think why I brought it back to that article issue, because there is a mystery in the title itself, in a sense. You know, it's, and I think this is what the whole poem is doing. It's hinting at something. It's something not very pleasant, right, that's happening, that's about to happen, that's sort of just, as you've said, it's under the surface sort of the text, but then it never quite happens, but there's always this premonition of it happening, and I think this is exactly what the title sort of sets stage for. Mm. And obviously it sets a certain confrontation as well, I think, because so the trees are conspiring, and we might assume, you know, who are they conspiring against? So probably the people, but specific people, a specific family. You know, the narrator in the poem is conversing with someone who is she, and again, assuming it's a she, conversing with. And so there are many, many questions, and I think it's, you know, it's almost to me like a title to a thriller book. You know, you don't want it to reveal too much, right? You want it to guide you into the book, but you still want to have all that essential mystery left for you to unravel as you read. And I think this is very similar to me. It works in a similar way.
I'm actually not... I'm a Russian speaker, but I don't speak Ukrainian at all, so I can see words and I can see their etymological background, but I can't actually understand the sentence when it's put together. But I did wonder about this word, if there wasn't also a hint of plot in it, as in a plot against the king, or, you know, a sort of historical plot, rather than a sort of a conspiracy theory, I suppose, a sort of direct action. And I wondered if that was in there or not at all, or...
So it definitely can also be understood as plotting, trees plotting against someone. And it's interesting here to even look at the very etymology of the word zmova in Ukrainian, because mova is language. So in order to have zmova, in order to make a plot, people have to gather together and talk, use mova, they need to converse. But here we have trees having this zmova. So trees are already very human-like in this way, if you look into the etymology of the very word used. So very interesting things to pick up even there.
How about you, William? Do you have any thoughts on the title, particularly on the title?
Yeah, I mean, the article was... I think I agree that something of... I was thinking of sort of, you know, horror movies or something like... I don't know, Day of the Triffids or something like that, or I don't know, Attack of the Martians or something. That's, I think that's why I actually reread it yesterday. I was like, why did I put the article and they really didn't? And I think that's maybe that was at the bottom of my mind. But yeah, I mean, the conspiracy is really interesting, because like Irina said, it is the word in Ukrainian does refer to speaking together, and you know, the trees actually they are very sort of personified. They have this is, I want to look in the face of the tree at the end, you know, which is very sort of strange. And the trees seem to be moving, and they have hands, or they have fingers in the original. I put hands because I was trying to approximate a rhyme, but it's actually fingers. So yeah, what I get from that is a very strong sense of nature having a kind of agency, actually, you know, and having a sort of, which can be potentially threatening and destructive in its own right. That's what I get from that.
I'm really conscious of the time. I want to speak for another 5 minutes or so and then open the floor to you. But I particularly want to ask about form, because you've both gone for slightly different approaches to the original form. But, and I just wondered if you could perhaps talk a little bit about the original form and how you reflected it in your English language version. So perhaps Irina, you know,
Yes, so this poem in the original, it uses meter and it has rhyme throughout the poem. So this is something that I've chosen not to reflect. It's always a painful choice for me, because obviously the music, the sound of the poem changes a lot if this is something that gets omitted. But then on the other hand, what I find is that if we are to try and recreate the same meter in English, English words do tend to be quite shorter than Ukrainian ones. And what you end up often needing to do, and I don't know if this is just sort of something I struggle with as a translator, but I see myself having to insert words that are not there originally just to fill in those missing syllables. And this is not something I like doing as well. So for me, I think my aim and my strategy was to take a poem and make it really be a poem in English, which I thought I could do more effectively, but then again, this is just sort of the limitations of my tools as a translator, let's say, and my vision as a translator, is to stay away from rhyme and meter. And I actually really like how William's version does preserve some of the rhymes. I mean, it's resurfacing there from time to time, and I think it gives it this sort of very special
beauty. Interesting, isn't it? Because there is a fundamental tension in the poem between the structure, which is quite fairy tale, is quite lulling, and the horror of what's bursting out of this beautiful music box. So that's an interesting kind of tension, which is, I mean, it's just that's just an observation, really. But tell me about your approach, William.
Yeah, well, I completely understand what you were saying about how you approached it. I did try to keep our rhythm and our sense of rhyme in it, not the same as the original, but I mean, I think, you know, my sort of approach was that the original has rhythm and rhyme, so mine will also have it. And it doesn't recreate exactly the same rhythm and rhyme as the original, but it's, you know, I've tried to approximate it as much as I could. But like you say, it does mean that you sort of find yourself searching around for the extra syllable and putting little things in, and obviously doing things like changing fingers to hands, yeah, because it's sort of, there's a little echo with hearts and hands. You know, it's not a sort of pure rhyme, but there are a couple of places where I had to do that. I mean, I guess the reason for doing that is because I feel like this is characteristic of Ukrainian poetry, which does still tend to be, like I think you wrote in your yes. notes, it still tends to have rhythm, and it still tends to rhyme. Not always, there are all kinds of different poets writing in Ukrainian, but that tends to dominate. So I thought, okay, you know, bringing a Ukrainian poem to an English language audience, I want them to experience that. Because I think it's kind of important. And it's sort of important, not just in the sense of this poem, but just in the sense of the poetic culture and the sort of tradition that it's coming out of. And I guess it's that sort of, you know, coming from the point of view of sort of foreignization a little bit more. So I think, you know, what you've done is come up with a poem that maybe Katarzyna Kolytko, as an English language writer, would probably have written. You know, she probably wouldn't have written mine if her language was English. She would probably have written yours. You know, but mine is, you know, what sort of trying to give you the experience of the Ukrainian reader. You know, so I guess it's so interesting that we both.
So
you know,
fascinating.
I as the English speaker was kind of much more being much more careful and trying to have more respect for the original. Yeah.
That William's version does preserve some of those couple of little details that I omitted elsewhere. I think the part where the woodworms, as mentioned in the original, it's been, you know, the work of 5 years for the woodworms to carve that headboard. But in reality, you know, it's not something you see in my translation. I just say carved by persistent woodworms. That's it.
But you do preserve that little detail, for instance, which arguably, you know, is also something in the fabric of the poem. So it's
interesting. And is it fair to say, do you think, Irina, that you, when I read it, you slightly heightened the sense of violence, it seems to me, this is again an observation, it's certainly not a criticism, but, and for example, William has took the parents for ourselves, which sounds like they were gathered up and in, whereas you've got took the parents away, which definitely has a sense of maybe some sort of, I don't know, ethnic cleansing or genocide to it. The parents go, they're taken away and they don't come back. And I was really interested by that difference, because you certainly sort of slightly upped it in... I just wanted if you'd talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's always... Well, it's also always the difference of how we perceive a certain poem. Yes. Because what I aim for as a translator is always trying to hit that right note, right, when you sing... Even when you, you know, sing the same song in a different language, right, you still need to preserve that melody, you still need to hit the right notes. So for me, this is very much the note that's present in the original. And to me, this, what in Ukrainian sounds, «взяли собі їхніх батьків», it does sound to me as a violent act in that context. So for me, what I think happens is that when maybe you make the translation more laconic, I think it actually heightens, in a sense, the emotional drive of the poem. I think for me that was one of the reasons why I didn't want, you know, the extra there, them, something, you know, eating for 5 years. I really wanted the essence of a poem to be very much there. So I think this might be just slightly heightened because the details are omitted in what stays. Again, not so many details. I don't want to sound like I took, you know, threw things out of the window completely. But, yeah, I think it might be one of the effects of that.
William, you've gone for a slightly slower burn in the sense that, you know, the details kind of poke up through something that appears much less frightening at first glance, and then suddenly there are all these notes that are dissonant. And so it's completely, with sort of completely different take, but there are very different. I'm just going to throw it open to you for a few minutes. I thought you might like to comment on the translations or add your thoughts or ask questions. Yes, do you have a question there?
Yeah. Well, I have a few things bubbling in my head. I'm originally Norwegian, and in Norwegian there are two different words for translation. Prose is oversetter, which is the same origin as translate. But when someone translates a poem, a yen dicta, which literally means again poem, make a new poem. So it's a completely different word used for translating poetry than that used for translating prose. So it's the whole business of exactly what you're talking about, making something new, making a new poem in another language. And I'm finding this very interesting compared with last year, because as I remember, last year was a French poem, so virtually everyone in the audience could understand the original. And both the translators, I think, English was their tongue.
Yes, that's right, yes.
And with all respect, Irina, you speak devastatingly good English, but I guess it's not technically your mother tongue.
No, it's not. It's not. It's my second language.
Yeah. Sorry. Whereas it is Williams, is that right?
Yes.
So it's very interesting, because as you know, commercial translator, I used to be a commercial translator, there are strict rules and agencies you only translate it into your mother tongue. But I mean, it is your mother tongue. You have a wonderful adopted mother, it's your time, you can remake completely. But coming back to the point about not being able to refer back to and understand the original, you know, we're slightly at sea about, you know, the choice of either dream or sleep, whereas in the French poem, we knew exactly whether the original was dream or sleep. So it's an interesting difference from last year, and just, you know, wondering why one's chosen sleep and the other dream. So anyway,
what becomes clear is that there is another text, which is the original. And in some ways it's important, but in other ways it's not actually particularly important anymore, because these two manifestations have appeared.
But it's a kind of dynamic between them.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes.
Can I just ask, was it discussed at any stage the possibility of producing a literal translation? I know some translation groups work in that way, translation centre.
For whom?
For today.
For you?
For us, yes. Yeah.
Well, I'm interested in that because I personally don't believe in literal translations. I don't think they exist. I don't think there is such a thing.
You have to. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you put 1,000 words for each word, or
In a sense, if I may, because I think this goes to, this is answering your question, but kind of going towards your question. You know, this sleep and dream thing. So in Ukrainian, we have two different words for when you dream when you sleep. And for when you dream, as in I dream about a house by the sea. Those are two different words. Whereas we don't have that luxury in English. Strangely, because normally it's English has a lot of synonyms for everything, but some things like dream. So in this poem, this is particularly the dreams that you have when you sleep. And for me, for instance, the choice of sleep and the trees stealing the sleep rather than the dreams, I didn't really want to have to mislead my reader and have them possibly think, oh, this is about, you know, dreams, this is about, you know, my inspirations, my aspirations, things like that. So for me, for instance, that was the reason for the choice. But so yes. I think William's choice is absolutely as valid because it is, well, a dream, I guess, if you translate it literally, but a specific kind.
Well, it is because it's plural, because it's sne, son. Son is a dream or sleep. Or like son's even like the state of sleeping, I guess. But sne would be things we see in our dreams. Yeah. However, you're right, of course. As a reader, an English language reader might think of it as dreams and aspirations, which is not. But it's
just because it's so out of the context in this first sentence that the trees will steal our dreams. And then your reader can go either way. And if you want them to go a certain way, then, in a sense, I changed it to sleep, that they will steal our sleep, so our possibility to dream in our sleep, in a sense. But
so interesting to hear that there are these two different words.
This in.
I'm just intrigued. There's more point, but it intrigues me. What about this rim? It seems such a strong detail, either to turn up in a poem from nowhere, or to be committed. In one translation, William's translation, it turns up and Irina's not.
What was it? The rib.
Oh, the rib. Yeah.
It fits in very well. It's a ghastly idea somehow that fits in with this background of genocide and occupation and so on. You have to look at the most recent Ukrainian history to know that
do you want to, William?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, that's just my favourite image, I think, of the whole poem. I mean, obviously, it's not a pleasant image, but I think it's sort of one of the strongest images. And I thought that this idea of, it's actually ribs in plural in the original, so it's perimishu rebrami, with my ribs, cough, kasha. So it's in the cauldron of my chest, I mix with my ribs a cough or the cough. There's no article. I felt that there was something. It is a slightly sort of gruesome image as well, and that sort of using the rib to do it. So I thought that it was. But then it's not just one rib. So in my poem, there's an image of somebody with one implement going like this, which in the original. Well, it's with my ribs, so it's actually something slightly different that's going on.
That's interesting because this was actually, I think, the reason why I decided to omit it from mine, because if you preserve this plural of ribs, you get something like a blender image, and this was not something that exactly was fitting with the rest of the poem, so I think this is where William went for singularizing it, and I went for, okay, let her just be stirring cough in the pot of her chest, but with something. Mm-hmm. Let's assume she's using something.
You use the word pot in that line. The pot, you know, stirring the cough in the pot of my chest. There's something so domestic and wonderful about the word pot and the echo of the sound of the cough. It's almost automatic for a second there, isn't it? Yeah. Mm. I think it does work beautifully, though I did really like the rib as well.
just come back to William on that, because you were talking about the word cauldron and the...
Yeah, and it goes so well with the image, with the choice of words you have, because it's something, you know, the Macbethian kind of...
I mean, I really like the way your line sounds. Like, it sounds, sort of phonetically, it sounds really nice, but I think the word used in the original, kazanok, it's more of a... It's like a metal... big metal cooking dish, so big black metal cooking dish, I think.
But then again, it's kazanok, so the kazan is a big one.
Yeah,
kazanok is a small one, so kazanok is something you can put on a stove, for instance. So it's very, very ambiguous. It's quite,
Which is another problem with, is diminutives, so Slavic languages like Ukrainian and Russian and Polish and lots of others have diminutives, and we don't have them. It's one of the great sort of poverties of English that we don't really... We have them here and there.
Small, small, little that.
But a potlet, something like that, but it sounds funny. But also almost any word in Ukrainian you can make small by adding a diminutive suffix. And that's what she's done here. Like, it's, how do I do that with cauldron? Like, it's, you can't do it, you know. A little cauldron starts to sound a bit silly, you know, so.
Yeah. I like the way Rib picks up later with the skeleton image from the broken spine.
Boat spine.
That was actually a line that I found difficult to understand, to be honest, about the boat.
I think for me it's one of my favorite parts, actually, exactly because of that. That for me it's also the boat keeping watch or guarding.
Mm.
What is it guarding? So in your version, for instance, it's guarding the bank.
Yes.
But again, literally, it's just there on the bank,
guarding. On the bank. Yeah.
But what it's guarding is never specified. Mm. So here's where we also had to do the guessing, and you know, I sort of went with just, okay, keeping watch. But I'm very curious myself, and I wish Katya was here so that we could ask her, what is that boat guarding? Who is it guarding? And, well, you know, who is running away and who is telling them to run away and all those things.
And it sounds as though it's failed in its guardianship anyway, because it's been broken, it's been spoiled.
And I think one interpretation that I like in particular is thinking of a boat as something made of a, well, dead tree, but that object not being quite dead. So even all those trees taken away and made into those seemingly safe everyday objects, that they have the agency of their own. And that boat is actually waiting for someone to take them into that cold mist where, as we know, you know, that tree is lurking, that tree is lurking. So,
but again, in that line, your line is more violent, I think, than William's. Twisted and numbed is actually a really violent kind of twisted, whereas, I mean, broken is broken, but cause is not an act of violence in the way that... Interesting.
The original studit is just a kind of cool down, or I guess, it's a kind of hard to work out what's going on.
Well, we have the word studin, for instance, which is also used to indicate very strong cold. So it's, studit, you can be studit, you know, some soup in your spoon.
Mm-hmm.
When you blow on it, it's studit in Ukrainian. Yeah. But then also it is used to indicate the very opposite when it's very strong cold. So again, which is it? You know, the river just cooling down, or is the river, you know, freezing
it
up?
Is it a gentle verb, or is it a violent verb in some way? I don't know. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm interested in your alternatives of swim and sail with the cartoons. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, sail things are pretty upright. That's how they relate to the
Well, this is the opposite of sleep dream. So this is where in English we have two words, but in Ukrainian we use the same word for sailing and for swimming. So it's plisty. Випливе. Крізь холодний туман припливе. So припливе will sail or will swim or will sail out or will, well, basically will arrive, literally will arrive by sailing / by swimming.
Arrive by moving it through or on water.
Yeah.
It's so interesting because in English, the sail actually, especially for the tree, thinking masts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In Ukrainian, are there other verbs that distinguish between actually swimming yourself and being in the boat? It's extraordinary if there are.
No, not really. Not really. Yeah. Not in a sense of floating, not in a sense of swimming. No. I mean, it's just, I mean, there are words that denote specific objects, you know, that have to do with swimming or like anchors. But no. Well, there's one with slovate, which is to row.
To row, yeah, you can row.
But that's about the only one.
It was really interesting that you mentioned it. It would be nice to ask Katya what she actually meant. What if you have translated poems of poets that you could get in touch with and discuss stuff, right? Mm. But also chose not to, perhaps, or couldn't, because that wouldn't be a possibility. And I suppose if you can't have that dialogue with them, then some of the mystery remains, I guess, because poems, the way we read them or the way we hear them, we don't get an interpretation from the author usually. So by asking the question, do you then explain it to your readers more than you would otherwise? I was just wondering if you could comment on that a bit more. Is it useful to ask?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. I mean, sometimes it's useful, but I think it's more useful for more kind of pragmatic things. You know, if there's just like some kind of obscure word that you just don't know what that is or what it means. Whereas if it's a question of interpretation, I sort of would rather interpret it myself. I mean, the reader has to interpret it. I interpret it. Does the author, you know, sometimes authors aren't clear. You know, they haven't thought about it, I would say, when you ask them. And they don't know. Now we're having questions about the translations, and actually, we're not quite sure why we chose those words. You know, I think it's for some things yes, but for some things, I think the role of the author is kind of, you know, should be sort of a little bit distanced. But I don't know. I mean, what you guys think?
Yeah, I think it's such a great question because exactly, you know, we sort of assume that there is a certain way to read a poem. And we often hope that, well, at least a poet will know, right? But, you know, being a poet as well as a translator, I often have no clue why a specific image just sort of comes into a poem. Or what is it doing in that poem exactly? Or did you mean specifically this or that? Well, maybe I meant both. Or maybe... So it's, you know, I think it's one of the things that make poetry so beautiful, that it's so many layers of different readings. And I do think that they don't have to be mutually exclusive. They actually coexist. So you have the poet's own reading of their poem. You have the reader's reading of a poem. You have a translator's reading or the readings of the multiple readers and multiple translators. So I think there's a beauty in it because I think each poem actually contains all that, if you think about it. And it's just amazing how far it can actually stretch and how many things it can fit.
There is a difficulty I always find in translating from Ukrainian or from Russian, indeed, into English, is that actually a lot of the ambiguity, and I put that in the notes on the thing, the ambiguity that those languages can afford, you can't have in English, because English tends to be much more precise, whether it's like, you know, we have a much more complex tense system, which tells you precisely when things happened and in which order, which you don't necessarily have in Ukrainian, or, you know, you can miss out pronouns, you can miss out possessive pronouns, there are no articles, so, you know, you can have these sort of verbless sentences often, sort of impersonal constructions, passive constructions, all things which provide all this kind of very rich ambiguity and all this space for interpretation. And then I find when I'm putting it into English, I'm always having to like cut that out, you know, and sort of fill in these dots, you know, join up the dots. Exactly. And it's sort of it's really unavoidable to do it to a certain degree.
I find that to some extent this has to do with the fact that Ukrainian poets write a lot of syllabotonic poetry, sort of using meter and rhyme. Because what I feel is that when you work with language in that way, when language comes in much more into your writing, you often go with the language to further extents than you would otherwise. So for me, for instance, I would say that poetry written in English, especially contemporary poetry, is much more conceptual often, in a sense, that it works with contact, with rational images, or more or less rational. This is, you know, very quote-unquote rational, of course. But this is my perception, for instance, coming from a different poetic tradition. And this was something new and very interesting for me when I just started reading poetry in English myself. And so I think in Ukrainian and in Katya's work as well,
you will sometimes get things literally popping out of the language itself, which I find very fascinating. And they are also the most difficult ones to translate.
Yes.
Because you just need to either translate them literally or omit them, or because it's often impossible to give the sense of language sort of growing and this song, the things blooming on it, in a sense, you know.
You see what I mean? This is complete revelation, this session. I always learn so much. I think we have to draw to a close. I'm really, really sorry, but you can carry on asking William and Irina questions afterwards. Sometimes at the end of the duel, we ask you if you want to judge which translation is better, but most of the time people just throw up their hands in despair because it becomes patently obvious that it is two very different poetic manifestations, equally of worth, equally of interest. And so I'd like you to join with me in thanking Irina and William for all their work on this beautiful translation.